Good morning. Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Flory, Riley, and Smith, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Just a couple of introductory comments. Our technology here has worked surprisingly well over the course of the last few months, but as you know, technology is unpredictable. And so if you cannot hear me or you lose your connection, audio connection at any time, at least wave your hands. I can see everyone except Judge Smith, who does not have a video connection today, although she hears what's going on. But I just want to make sure, Mr. Nyvold, can you hear me okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. How about you, Mr. Everson?
I can. Thank you.
All right. And Judges Riley and Smith, I see Judge Riley nodding. Judge Smith, are you hearing me?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Perfect. We'll get going then. Just please place your microphones on mute when you're not speaking so that we don't hear the rattling of the papers and things like that. Otherwise, as you both know from your experience, you both have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for all appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. If you wish, and please both of you identify yourselves for a record as you begin your arguments. And with that, Mr. Nyvold, you may proceed. This is State of Minnesota versus Xavier Alfred Haywood, court file A19-1162. You may proceed, Mr. Nyvold.
Oh, good morning, and may it please the court. Mark Nyvold representing Mr. Haywood. I'd like to first try to touch all three of my issues, so I'll get through each of them as quickly, but obviously any questions are most welcome. On the issue of the denial of the motion to remove the trial judge, the first problem there is that the chief judge did not apply the correct standard, did not apply the reasonable examiner as defined as an objective layperson fully informed of all the circumstances. Instead, the chief judge clearly used her own perspective to decide that motion. And I think I've laid that out pretty clearly, but that by itself just invalidates the ruling. Without that, you can't get an accurate ruling on the impartiality or lack of impartiality.
But so Mr. Nyvold, this is Judge Riley, she did cite Jacobs and said, and quoted, a judge is disqualified under the Code of Judicial Conduct if a reasonable examiner with full knowledge of the facts and circumstances would question the judge's impartiality. She also said that.
Yes, but she didn't define a reasonable examiner as an unbiased layperson fully informed. In other words, it has to be the perspective of a lay person. And the court clearly did not do that because she didn't include that language that it has to be a lay person. And then the court's own statements show she applied her own viewpoint. She says the court believes that the judge strives to be fair, and the court believes that he will do that here. Those are straight from the judge. Those are her own views on this. There's just no way this can be construed as having applied the correct standard.
I know that you argue that a structural error analysis should apply to this. I'm wondering how you respond to the Supreme Court's statement in State v. Mundt that it has limited the remedy of structural error to impartial judge claims in which the defendant established actual bias of the judge as a trier of fact. I'm getting at whether or not there's a difference when it's a court trial versus a jury trial like we had here.
Well, in Dorsey was a trial by judge. I don't think there's a difference. Clearly, it's structural error here. Finch says the presence of
the Supreme Court seems to make a distinction between a bench trial and a jury trial, as I read through the various cases.
Your Honor, I'm not seeing that at all. You have Pratt, which involved a jury trial, and that was the case of the judge who had been engaged by the prosecutor's office to be an expert witness. That judge, this court in its own opinion in Pratt, and the Supreme Court as well, makes clear that that judge did not say or do one thing that would indicate a bias or prejudice, but it was the fact of having an arrangement with the prosecutor's office that by itself created an appearance of partiality.
They
gave him a new trial, and there's I don't see any distinction between, and this was a jury trial, and I understand that, but having a, and Pratt says the fact that there was a jury here does not make a difference in the outcome.
Counsel, this is Judge Smith. So, and maybe Pratt answers it. Some of the cases that you cited, Dorsey, others, I think it was an actual bias or lack of impartiality finding. And the quote that Judge Riley referenced was actual bias. So you're saying that Pratt is a case that applied a structural error analysis to a finding of a reasonable appearance of lack of impartiality,
you'd say, yes. That
as opposed to actual bias.
Yes, and in fact, in Dorsey, they didn't find actual bias. That was where the judge went out and did her own investigation. They didn't find actual bias there. They said that was the appearance. And I'm not alleging we don't have to show actual bias here, and we're not claiming that. So this case is squarely controlled by Pratt, by Finch, and we don't have to show that the fact that there was a jury somehow did or didn't make a difference. That's irrelevant under case law. And Judge Riley, could I ask you? I'm not sure I got the pronunciation of that case. Is that Munt, M-U-N-D-T?
It's M-U-N-T. M-U-N-T.
Okay. All right.
How does Moelle, if that's how you pronounce it, factor into your analysis?
Well, Moelle is not at all relevant to this case. First of all, it makes the mistake in saying that we've never required or granted a new trial just on the basis of the appearance of impartiality. We've always required prejudice. Well, that's not correct. State versus Dorsey says, accordingly, when a defendant has been deprived of an impartial judge, automatic reversal is required. And now I understand that since then, there's been a question like in Pratt, do we apply structural error or, you know, do we look, you know, for prejudice? But let me get the case here. Because there they had to ask, they decided, the state argues that Pratt has shown no prejudice and therefore should apply the Lilleberg factors and show prejudice. Well, Pratt said that if you satisfy either standard, it doesn't make a difference. And here there's clearly structural error based on the judge's statements indicating that he'd already decided on a key element of the destruction of evidence charge that Haywood had committed that he had destroyed evidence. So this is clearly a judge who had made statements that indicating a lack of impartiality, and that's sufficient. That's structural error. You don't have to show actual prejudice.
What if, counsel, what if the finding that you're talking about, so you're talking about the finding in the earlier trial, and
yes,
and what if the same exact case had come in the Noah King trial, but the district court just hadn't written that one italicized sentence about Mr. Haywood in its finding of fact number 44? In other words, the evidence, in fact, did prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what Judge Munger wrote, but Judge Munger didn't need to say that to make the decision in that case. So if there had just been silence, would there have been, would it be error not to remove the judge?
Well, that's a totally different circumstance.
That's what I'm asking. It's a different circumstance. Does the circumstance have to do with the judge hearing the trial
or does the circumstance have to do with that proved that? Let's assume it did prove it beyond reasonable doubt. Or is it the judge saying it? I'm just asking to
We can't. I mean, if that statement had not been made and I came here and I said, well, I think the Judge Munger, he was thinking that Haywood was guilty. Okay. If he hadn't said it, I don't think I obviously wouldn't have as strong an argument for claiming he showed a lack of impartiality, but he did say it and he did it. It was totally unnecessary. This was King's trial. If he was going to say, have any plausible basis for making a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that Haywood destroyed evidence, it would have been in Noah Baker's case, but Baker pled guilty. Baker's the one Haywood allegedly helped burn these clothes. So there, okay, maybe it has some relevance, but to come right out and say this guy's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of destroying evidence, in contrast that with Pratt. Pratt got a new trial, and the judge never said or did one thing that you could say was overtly biased or indicated prejudice or prejudgment of anything. It was simply the relationship. This is coming out of the judge's own mouth.
Well, this
this isn't something a relationship like, oh, you know a friend of a friend of a prosecution witness.
Mr. Nival, this is Judge Riley. So this judge presided over the three prior cases involving the three people who were there when Grayek was shot. And then he presided over this case. So that's, I would imagine, pages and pages of transcript. We also have him saying that your client, Mr. Haywood, he's going to get a stay in court. I'm going to be fair to him when that day comes. And there are no allegations that the judge demonstrated any prejudice during the jury trial. And the jury never, whatever they based their verdict on was based on what came in at Mr. Haywood's trial, presumably, because you haven't raised anything else.
Well, first, if I may, Judge Riley, I don't think that's accurate to say he said he would be fair to Haywood. I think he made a general statement that I try to be fair, okay? He wasn't guaranteeing Haywood anything. His general statement that I try to be fair, well, that's a given. Everybody expects that. But what they don't expect is where the judge knows he's going to be sitting in this trial. He's going to be presiding. He knew that. He had all the cases. He knew Haywood was coming up. And then he finds him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and contrasts that with Pratt and these other cases where there's...
But what I'm getting at is that he wasn't... When it came to your client's conviction, it was entered after a jury found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, this is a jury trial. There's no question, but that's almost essentially irrelevant in deciding whether or not the judge, his impartiality could reasonably be questioned. Would anybody here, if they were awaiting trial in front of this judge, and as to a key element of the offense you're awaiting for trial, that judge said, so-and-so, this person is guilty or beyond a reasonable doubt, they did that offense element, would anybody be comfortable going to trial? And this case is just, it goes well beyond the basis or the showing that needs to be made in Pratt and Finch, in Dorsey, as to the appearance of partiality. If there are no more questions, I'd like to move on to my second argument, which is the hearsay admission of hearsay despite the no showing of unavailability of the witness and the no showing that the statement was made in circumstances that show it was trustworthy.
So let's skip to the second part of that argument. Let's say that we agree with you. How do you respond to the state's argument that, well, that may be true, but it could have come in under this other reason, i.e. that it wasn't hearsay, wasn't made for the, to prove the truth of the matter asserted, and that we can consider that alternative argument. I'd like you to respond to that.
Well, look at what the state had to prove, Your Honor. They had to prove not that, not just that these Mr. Grayheck was killed. They had to prove that Haywood knew or had reason to know that the other three had committed the crime. In other words, it's not like after the fact, you know, he hears about reasons in the news and then realizes, oh, I helped these guys, you know, who were committed this. He had to know at the time he was doing the alleged aiding that this man had been killed. And that's what that statement was key to proving. It wouldn't have sufficed just to offer that to prove belief. That's not why they proved it or presented it. They had to prove this element that the defendant destroyed, or that the defendant knew or had reason to know that Davenport, King, and Baker committed the crime, murder. So they had to prove the murder. And just putting in the certified convictions does not prove that Haywood knew that. That just proves that they were killed and that, or that the man was killed and that these other three were convicted of it. It doesn't prove what Haywood knew at the time. So they had to prove to that jury that Haywood, that a murder had been committed and Haywood knew it.
Well,
and
there's
that's the problem.
As I understand it, Davenport had stated that they, and I'm quoting now, did a robbery and it went bad.
Yes.
Well, there are lots of ways robberies can go bad or sideways.
Well, the clear implication there was that it became worse than a robbery. Okay. And the state was very keen on getting that in. They thought that that was very probative of proving that Haywood knew a murder had occurred. I mean, they fought like crazy to get that in. And they did establish the requirements. And the other thing is that the judge's ruling on this has no legal basis. He never required the state to prove unavailability of the declarant, because he basically just forced the issue. He said, this man will invoke the privilege. He's unavailable. All of that was wrong. He was sitting in the jail. He'd signed the transport order. The man was there.
Mr. Nyvold, your time is up. I'll let you conclude your argument here, but we also have your briefing on this issue.
Okay, just one last statement about the sentence, or the setting of the severity level.
You can address that in your rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you.
Right. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Michael Averson. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. And I would like to briefly begin with the second issue that Mr. Nyvold was just talking about, that being the admissibility of the statement. It didn't go the way I wanted it to go. And I think Mr. Nyvold has really made the point that I was trying to make, and that is that the purpose of this statement was to prove Mr. Haywood's knowledge of these facts, not to prove the truth of the matter asserted in the facts. That was what the state used that statement for, and therefore that statement is not hearsay and is not excluded by the hearsay rule. Now, to get back to the first issue, excuse me, the state would submit that an objective examiner with full knowledge of the facts and circumstances in this case simply would not question the district court's impartiality and ability to fairly preside over appellant's trial. And when you take a look at the chief judge's order, it is clear that she is applying the correct standard. As one member of the panel pointed out, she discussed this standard in the first page of the memorandum, and then in the last page of her order and memorandum, this is page 7, the judge says, and I quote, "This court holds that a reasonable examiner with full knowledge of the facts and circumstances would not question Judge Munger's impartiality." So that reflects that the district court that the chief judge understood and correctly applied the appropriate standard. And there was ample evidence to support what the district court, what the chief judge did in this record. And that is further supported by the longstanding presumption that a district court judge is capable of setting aside information learned in the course of his or her judicial duties and presiding over a case in a fair and impartial way. And the two claimed facts here that appellant cites to in an effort to try to overcome this presumption simply does not do so. The first is a brief comment that the district court judge made at Mr. Davenport's sentencing. Judge noted the senseless nature of the crime, and in doing so, noted that the evidence in Mr. Davenport's case showed that the only apparent connection between Mr. Davenport and the victim before the murder was, between Mr. Davenport and the victim before the murder was Mr. Hayward. He was simply commenting on what the evidence was at Mr. Davenport's trial. And of course, the judge also went on to note that Mr. Hayward's day in court is in the future, and that the issues in Mr. Hayward's case relate to facts that occurred after the murder, not before the murder. Simply no basis to overcome the presumption there. As to Mr. King's trial, the issue in that case was whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt Mr. King's guilt. The district court, in analyzing the evidence and explaining its outcome, made a brief finding that certain evidence of Mr. Haywood and Mr. Baker leaving the hotel corroborated other evidence. There was no finding that the state proved anything as to Mr. Haywood's guilt. Again, this does not...
Counsel, this is Judge Smith. Isn't the finding about Mr. Haywood essentially that he was involved in disposing of evidence, and isn't that critical to his actual charge and later trial?
What the district court said, and give me just one moment, all the district court said is time spent by defendants Hayward and Noah Baker away from the motel coincided and corroborated police hypothesis that the defendants were disposing of evidence. He was simply noting a corroborating fact in the context of Mr. King's trial. There is no finding that Mr. Haywood has been proven guilty of any crime here. There's no finding that Mr. Haywood knew about the disposing of the evidence. It's simply the court explaining its rationale for finding Mr. King guilty. And I go back again.
Well, it seems to say to me that defendant Haywood, that the time corroborated the police hypothesis that Mr. Haywood was disposing of evidence by burning it during the time frame.
Correct.
And the defendants, I think it's referring to Mr. Haywood because it is earlier in that same sentence.
Correct. I think you're right about that. And again, all the district court is doing is it's explaining its rationale for finding Mr. King guilty. And that is not enough to overcome the presumption that district court judges are not able to set aside, or that the presumption that district courts are able to set aside collateral knowledge gained in the course of their judicial duties. I also think it's important here that Mr. Hayward's trial was a jury trial, and I would point this court to State versus Newell. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the 2009 Minnesota Supreme Court opinion on page 714. The Minnesota Supreme Court says, critically, the jury, the fact finder here, was never exposed to concerns about Newell's testimony that counsel raised during the ex parte conversation. So I think that language reflects that it is appropriate to factor in that this was a jury trial. Now, the state would submit, even if this were a court trial, that there would be no basis to remove Judge Munger.
Well, how do you respond, this is Judge Riley, how do you respond to Mr. Nievold saying, Pratt, there wasn't even any indication in that record that the judge made any comments about the case, that particular case, showing partiality. And then I also would like you to respond to Mr. Nyvold's comment on page 8 of his reply brief that says that if Haywood is not granted a new trial, this will be the first case in which a defendant whose trial judge's impartiality could reasonably be questioned, or that the judge had actual bias, was not granted a new trial.
Okay, to begin with your first question, Judge Riley, Platt is a case about a judge's financial interest in a particular outcome, and that in Platt, the judge had an agreement to serve as an expert witness for the county attorney, and that is covered, that is a specific line covered in the rule about judge disqualification. If there is a financial interest in the outcome, or if some kind of financial relationship with one of the parties, that is a reason that a district court judge must recuse him or herself or be removed. That's not what we have here. I mean, the focus in Pratt was on that financial relationship. What we have here is we have an analysis as to whether or not the presumption that a district court judge will be unable to set aside this collateral knowledge has been overcome, and that presumption simply has not been overcome. Now, with respect to Mr. Nyvold's point on page 8, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that kind of goes to whether this is a structural error or whether there are additional considerations. I would, one, point this court back to the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Newell, where the court expressly says that we have never held that reversal is automatic when a party succeeds in raising a reasonable question about the judge's impartiality. Rather, we have applied the three-factor test to determine whether the error requires reversal.
But we also have the case of Colbert versus State, and the Supreme Court recognized that the denial of the right of an impartial judge is a structural error. The Supreme Court seems to say it's structural error when you have an partial judge.
Correct. If it's based upon actual bias, so an actual basis, and this is actually one of the points that I think the court makes in Pratt, that was based upon an actual fact that established actual bias by the judge. When you're dealing with, and this is what was going on in Newell, you're dealing with an appearance of impropriety or an appearance of the lack of impartiality, and the Supreme Court in Newell draws that distinction between actual bias versus the appearance of impartiality, excuse me. I'll also note that this court in State versus Cleary, which we cite in our brief, this court actually applied the three factors. And of course, the court in that case found that the three-factor test was met. But this court's decision in State versus Cleary makes clear and actually applies. It's not simply dicta, as counsel suggested of Newell. It is the court applying those factors in a case involving the appearance of impropriety.
I authored that case, and it's a little different because it was a probation violation. A little different than trial.
Correct. And I don't rely much on the factual basis, but I think Cleary is applicable in the sense that it provides the structure that the court uses when analyzing a claim that there is an appearance of lack of impartiality. I think Cleary, as well as Newell, makes clear that that is the appropriate standard to be applied. So what we are ultimately left here is we are ultimately left with an instance where a judge has made no specific findings about proof that appellant committed any particular crimes, no finding that the state has proved anything as to Mr. Haywood. And frankly, if we accept Mr. Haywood's position in that case, that would mean many district court judges would need to recuse themselves from presiding in cases that are remanded on appeal if that judge has made any sort of factual finding in the first proceeding. And that is not what the law is. That is not the way our justice system works. Our justice system presumes judges are capable of setting aside outside knowledge. In fact, that's one of the key criteria for somebody to become a judge, that they are able to do just that. And the state would submit that happened in this case, and that the chief judge properly denied the motion to remove Judge Munger. Unless there are any other questions on that point, I will briefly address the third issue raised by Mr. Haywood, and that goes to whether there was an abuse of discretion in assigning a severity level 10. And when you look at the judge's comments at the sentencing, they reflect that the judge carefully considered the Kennard factors and provided sufficient reasons that justified its decision to assign a severity level 10. The judge focused on the conduct that occurred here, that is covering up a first degree murder, aiding the flight, bringing supplies to the hotel room, helping to retrieve and destroy evidence that ultimately resulted in preventing, and a goal of preventing, the identification and apprehension of not just one violent perpetrator of a murder, but three. That, I think, is an important factor as well, that he was aiding three people and avoiding apprehension here. The judge also made a note that Tara Baker pled guilty. There was an agreement to assign her a severity level 8, and her conduct involved significantly less serious conduct than Mr. Haywood. And the court also considered the severity level assigned to other offenders who aided both first-degree murder as well as second-degree murder, noted that the data showed most of the assignments were somewhere between an 8 and a 10, and the judge, in looking at the conduct in this particular case, made a determination, exercised his discretion to assign a severity level 10. And we would submit that that is not an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court.
Counsel, this is Judge Smith. I know we only have seconds remaining, but I just wanted to go back to a moment to the disqualification issue, because in looking at Pratt, I mean, Pratt gives, I don't even know if it uses the word structural error or not. It seems in the analysis, it just reverses it, as I see. And then, and it cites to a violation of Rule 2.11a. of the rules of judicial conduct. And I'm struggling with the Supreme Court case law in that rule, because that, and whether it's structural or a different test, because I mean, that rule A, that's the, it's the very introduction of it, and says a judge will disqualify him or herself in any proceeding in which the impartiality might reasonably be questioned, including in the following circumstances, and it has other circumstances. So it doesn't, the rule itself doesn't talk about actual bias versus reasonable peer. I'm trying to figure out how this all works together with the case law.
Absolutely. If I know my time has expired, if I can give a very brief response.
You may. Go ahead, Mr. Everson.
Thank you very much. You know, one, I would point the court to footnote 9 of Pratt, where the Supreme Court talks about whether it is a structural error or not when we're dealing with an appearance of impropriety is, at that time, an open question. They talked about there had been some inconsistency in the past. That question has now been resolved. And two, a number of the subsequent cases, Muell, Cleary, all those cases, they draw, at least I believe Cleary did, but a number of the Supreme Court cases that are cited in both of our briefs draw that distinction between the appearance of lack of impartiality and actual bias. So with that, we would ask this court to affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Everson.
I have one question. So which case do you think answered that question left open in the footnote in Pratt?
I would say, at the very least, State versus Muell answered that question. The court clearly said that in circumstances where you have an appearance of lack of impartiality, we apply this test. And it may have been answered before that point, but it's clearly answered in You all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Everson. Mr. Nyvold, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you. The idea that Muell is the state of the law on whether prejudice or has to be shown is ridiculous. Number one, Muell didn't decide anything. Muell said, this guy hasn't even shown either the appearance or actual prejudice. There's just nothing here. It was the guy's lawyer telling the judge, I think my client may commit perjury. Okay, and that was, I believe, in a jury trial. It didn't go anywhere. If you read these cases, you will see how badly decided, or the language, some of the language and statements in Muell are just completely out of place, unsubstantiated. And if you look at, they say, we've never required or granted relief unless there's been a showing of prejudice. Well, that's wrong. Read State versus Dorsey. They didn't. They said when a defendant has been deprived of an impartial judge, automatic reversal is required. That's at page.
Well, counsel Dorsey, counsel this Judge Smith. I mean, Dorsey, the district court independently found facts. I think. I mean, when we look at, if we just step back a second, instead of to the purpose of structural error versus finding the type of risk of harm that Muell talks about, the type of prejudice that Muell talks about. I mean, when a district court in fact is biased or in fact finds facts through independent investigation or in fact does something wrong, it's much clearer that it has infected the whole trial in a way that is structural. Now, an appearance without knowing whether there is actually a problem with a judge's partiality, an appearance of partiality, the factors that are discussed, the risk to that trial, the risk to, public, the integrity to the process, whatever those factors are in Muell, seem to align with that difference, qualitative difference between the two.
Well, I'm going to reread Dorsey. I don't think they said that there was actual bias there. I think they were pretty careful about that. But the idea that now that there's not structural error where the judge makes a statement finding a defendant guilty of a key element of the charge that the judge in the trial in which that judge is going to preside is not structural error is just not supported by the case law. In terms of cases, I would ask the court to read Pratt and read Finch. And the point is, and I make this in my brief, I cite the cases, this would be the first time, one way or another, if the judge was showed a lack of impartiality or his impartiality could reasonably be questioned, that results in a new trial. It is never not where that finding is made. It has never not resulted in that. So there's some back and forth about, do we need to apply these Powell factors? It's nonsensical to apply the Powell factors here. Powell was a civil case. The defendant had no constitutional right to an impartial judge. This is just completely apart from that. And the Powell standard is based on the idea where the judge didn't even know he had a conflict, we're not going to give this guy a new trial. It's harmless error. And that stems from the Lilleberg case. The judge there didn't even know, he forgot that he was involved with had a distant connection to one of the parties. Well, yes, why would you give a new trial in that circumstance? This is a criminal case with a constitutional right to an impartial judge. And I discussed the Lilleberg factors anyway in my reply brief, and they're amply met. But that would just a decision here saying that we've applied the Lilleberg factors and he doesn't get a new trial where the judge's impartiality clearly could be reasonably questioned would just be way out far afield from where the law is in this state in terms of decided cases and what those cases say. Last point I want to address is the judge basically making a factual and legal determination that Baker, although he's convicted of second-degree murder, committed first-degree murder. And because that means three of all three men committed first degree murder, the severity level has to be 10. Well, logically and legally, how that can be justified, I have no idea. He can't declare Baker guilty of first degree, and he can't use that to decide the severity level. So we're asking to reverse the sentence. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nyvold and Mr. Everson, both. We the case was thoroughly briefed, we have the benefit of your arguments here today, and thank you for that. We will take this matter under advisement at this time, and we'll issue a decision on the matter within 90 days. We stand adjourned on this matter at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.